But first, we need to think about where we've got so far. We now know what symmetry is, but not how it's used in physics. All of our modern theories are based on these mathematical ideas of symmetry, including Einstein's famous ideas of relativity. But how and why is this the case? James Farr dragged me out of the office with a tennis ball to explain.
Einstein's theories completely revolutionised the way we think about gravity. And they were all sparked off by a simple fact which Einstein noticed about the speed of light, which we're going to think about now.
Okay, so what's this got to do with a tennis ball, though?
Well, the normal way we think about speeds is they add up in a very simple way. And to demonstrate this, if you can now go and stand about 10 metres or so away from me, Greer.
Okay, about 10 metres.
And if you can now throw the ball to me, not too hard, of course.
Okay, so I'm going to do an underarm throw. Ready?
There we go. That took about a second, say, to get to me. So we can say it was travelling at 10 metres per second. We both agree on that, right?
I'd say so, yeah.
So if we do this again, this time you're going to be running towards me as you throw the ball.
OK, I'll give you my best cricketer's throw, OK? Ready?
Go for it. Oh, that was much faster that time.
Sorry, Jeff.
That was quite all right. So the ball was much faster because you were running as you threw the ball. So you can add the speed you were running at, maybe 5 metres a second, onto the speed you threw the ball at, because you threw it just as hard as you did before. So we add 5 plus 10 to get about 15 metres a second. That's the overall speed of the ball relative to me. But how did the speed of the ball look relative to you?
Well, it didn't really feel or look any different to me.
Yeah, you threw the ball exactly as hard as you did before, so it should be the same speed. So here we've got a demonstration of two different observers, me and you, Greer, observing the same ball, but thinking that it's going at two different speeds.
Okay, so the movement of that ball is relative to us, you could say.
Exactly, and that's what's so different about light. If you were firing a beam of light rather than throwing a ball, the little photons which make up the beam of light would all seem to be moving at exactly the same speed, both from my perspective and from yours, even though you're moving relative to me.
Good to know, just in case I go throwing balls of light anytime soon.
Balls of light aside, this idea that light must always appear to travel at the same speed, no matter how fast or in what direction we're travelling, was Einstein's stroke of genius. He realised this by looking at the symmetries in the equations that describe light, as Daniel Bauman from the University of Cambridge explained.
One way of noticing that there's something symmetric going on is to notice that there's something that's not changing. If you look at a symmetric object from different points of view and they look the same, that's how you identify that an object is symmetrical rather than arbitrary. And so here there was also a hint that there was something that didn't change. Two different observers moving relative to each other would agree on the speed of light. And so underlying this, there's a hint that there's a symmetry that enforces this. And so that symmetry is what's called Lorentz symmetry or Lorentz invariance.
These so-called Lorentz symmetries aren't actually too complicated. If you can imagine trying to measure the distance between two points on a piece of paper, then no matter how much you rotate your piece of paper, that measurement will always stay the same, right? It's sort of the same for light, in that the speed of light must always be the same for every observer, which means that there must be some kind of underlying symmetry. But how do we know that this is true?
To a theorist, you know it's true because it's too beautiful not to be, in some sense. I think even Einstein once said, if an experiment came out that would disagree with his theory of relativity, both special and general, then it's too bad for the experiment. There must be something wrong with the experiment because the theory itself is too beautiful to fail. But of course, at a practical level, we do have now plenty of experiments that just show us that this is really what's happening.
How has this had an effect on physics?
One way, especially for theorists, I think it has demonstrated the power of pure thought in coming up with physical theories. So Einstein famously introduced these thought experiments, asked himself, what happens if I rush after a light ray, or what happens to time when a clock is traveling on a fast-moving, train, and things like that. So it's a very different way of doing physics, less driven by experimental data, but by just purity of thought. And symmetries, and trying to see how the power of symmetries actually restrict the types of physical laws we can be writing down. And so this attitude of letting yourself be guided by symmetry has become vital. And I think Einstein was one of the first. And then, of course, at a practical level, it has just permeated all of modern physics. A world without relativity, to me, is unimaginable.
We've heard about how symmetry is used in our theories of relativity, which we use to describe gravity. This is useful if we want to think about very big things, like planets moving around the sun, but what if we want to zoom right in and look at much smaller things, maybe atoms? I'm going to head across the road from the Institute of Astronomy, where I'll get to the Cavendish Laboratories. Historically, these labs have played a very important role in the build-up to what we now call the Standard Model.
I'm Professor Andy Parker. I'm the head of the Cavendish Laboratory. So the Standard Model is our current understanding of all the particles and forces between them that make up atoms or normal matter and indeed everything in the universe. So we have quarks, which are the constituents inside protons and neutrons and therefore make up the atomic nucleus and the bulk of the weight of the atom. And then outside of that are electrons, which circle the nucleus like little planets, and a bunch of other particles similar to electrons. And those two types of particles make up the matter in the Standard Model, and then the forces between them make up the interactions.
However, the journey to this theory was by no means an easy ride.
When we first turned on large accelerators, we started to make new particles by colliding things, and those new particles were coming out sometimes once a week when we were discovering what seemed to be a new fundamental particle, and people were talking about a zoo of particles.
The trouble was, it wasn't what you might expect from a zoo. There was no plaque telling you which species was which, and everything was mixed in together, lions with toucans and kangaroos all in one enclosure. Scientists needed a way to categorise these new particles, a bit like a zoo has a reptile house and an aviary. The Standard Model has helped us to do this using symmetry, and more recently, the Higgs boson, the particle which explains why things have mass.
In fact, the Large Hadron Collider, which discovered the Higgs, has just restarted and we're collecting data right now. And with the LHC data, we should be able to perhaps discover something really exciting.
Could potentially be very exciting indeed. James Farr reporting there.